Hello and welcome to Podiatrics Pediatric Podcasts. And today we're going to be talking in the third part of our three-part mini-series on neurology on the topic of cerebral palsy. So today we're going to be talking about, therefore our plan is to talk about the classification of cerebral palsy. We're going to be talking about any important anatomy. We're going to talk about differential diagnoses because the assertion that every child with increased tone, every child with spasticity is cerebral palsy isn't an accurate one, and it's worth being aware of. If it isn't cerebral palsy, what else could it be? And the fourth part is we'll be talking about relevant pharmacology, about some medications that are used in the management of cerebral palsy. So why learn about cerebral palsy? It's extensively examined in theory exams. It is in many medical schools a learning week on its own or heavily taught in the neurology curriculum. And it's easy to write questions about because we've got classification systems in place that make it very easy to defend. Oh, this is the right answer because, you know, they've got velocity-dependent increase in tone, therefore it's this. So that's very important for us. So cerebral palsy, some of the things that might lead us to think that a child may have cerebral palsy is in a child, say, before the age of 6 months, if they had poor head control, okay, so if they were picked up and their head was to fall back, and they weren't to get head control, that might be a sign. If the baby feels quite stiff, or therefore also feels quite floppy, so hyper or hypotonia might make you think that this is a baby with cerebral palsy. Extension and overextension of the back and the neck when cradled in someone's arms again, and legs getting stiff or crossing or scissoring in when they're picked up can also be another sign. In a baby older than 6 months of age, if they don't roll over in either direction, if they can't bring their hands together or have difficulty bringing their hands towards their mouth, and if they only reach out with one hand while keeping the other fisted, so that is getting dominance, so dominance of one hand or unilateral dominance early, so before the age of a year, is quite suggestive of cerebral palsy. In a baby older than the age of 10, if they crawl in a lopsided manner, so you're looking at asymmetry, if they push off with one hand or leg while dragging the other side, that is quite suggestive of them having hemiplegia. Okay, and if they don't crawl on all fours, but instead kind of moves around on their bum, that is quite suggestive as well. So how do we classify cerebral palsy? Well, cerebral palsy, the cause of cerebral palsy and the pathophysiology is worth quick mention before I say to you, how do we describe cerebral palsy? So the easiest way is to look at prenatal causes, perinatal causes and postnatal causes. So prenatal causes, if you've got any congenital brain problems, so malformations of your brain, that can cause it. If you've got intrauterine infections, there's lots of infections that can cause problems to your brain and intracranial calcifications. Probably the main ones are cytomegalovirus, rubella and toxoplasmosis. They are some of your torch infections that can cause intracerebral calcifications. Intrauterine strokes can do it as well, and chromosomal abnormalities. They're all prenatal. Perinatal are things like hypoxic ischemic insults, so that can, for example, be problems with the delivery and being deprived of oxygen. Central nervous system infections such as encephalitis and meningitis. Strokes, and also something called kininctorus, which we talked about. Unconjugated bilirubin, when it is bound to albumin, can cross your blood-brain barrier and deposit in your basal ganglia. Short term, that causes acute bilirubin encephalopathy. Longer term, untreated levels of unconjugated bilirubin in the blood can cross the blood-brain barrier lead to permanent and irreversible brain damage in the form of kininctorus or chronic bilirubin encephalopathy. Postnatal causes could be accidental and non-accidental trauma. So that could be shaking injuries. It could also be hitting of one's head or car accidents, etc. Central nervous system infections, again, strokes, etc. So how do we classify cerebral palsy? So we have got two methods. I'm going to talk to you about the geographical method. So the geographical classification of cerebral palsy is basically looking at what limbs are affected. And it's quite easy to understand if you remember what the words are. So mono means one. So monoplegia means you've got one extremity involved, and that's normally in your lower body. So for example, right leg's affected, monoplegia. Hemiplegia would be both extremities on the same side are involved. So for example, right arm and right leg. So monoplegia, right leg, hemiplegia, right arm and right leg. Paraplegia or paraplegia are when both lower extremities are equally involved. So that's usually when it affects both legs. So right leg could be left leg is monoplegia. Hemiplegia would then be on both sides. So that would be right arm and right leg or left arm and left leg. Paraplegia would be both right and left legs being affected. Diplegia would usually mean, well, first of all, your lower extremities are more involved than your upper. But diplegia is different to your paraplegia. So diplegia is the most common form. And we'll talk about diplegia in a little bit more. So paraplegia is your both lower extremities are equally involved. Okay, so para, and then you've got diplegia. Okay, it's worth me trying if I can, because these are terms that people don't tend to quite like. Paraplegia means you have problems with both legs. Okay, and that's normally the way that people would tend to describe it. And diplegia, often used, is mean that you get symmetrical involvement of both parts of your body. So diplegia normally means you would affect both arms, for example, or both legs. Okay, paraplegia and diplegia are used slightly differently. Quadriplegia is that all your extremities involved equally, so that's all four legs, but your head's normal. Total body is when you have four legs affected and you've got no head or neck control. And double hemiplegia is that all your extremities involved, upper more than lower. Okay, again, I would know the monoplegia, hemiplegia, your diplegia and quadriplegia are the ones that I would look at. So for example, if your one leg's involved, that's monoplegia. Left arm, left leg would be hemiplegia. If you're going to have both of your legs involved, that'd be paraplegia. So we then move on to where exam questions tend to come from. So actually this classification system is probably more useful to you for exams. So this is a physiological classification. So it's based upon what you see, okay? And corresponds to the area of the brain that's involved. So spastic is the most common physiological type of cerebral palsy. So this is spasticity is velocity dependent increase in tone, okay? And contractures are quite common in this type. And we'll talk about medications that you can use later on. But spastic cerebral palsy, spasticity is a velocity dependent increase in tone. The way I remember is that SP at the beginning of the word spastic are the first two letters of speed. So speed is another way of saying, isn't it? Speed and velocity are describing very similar thing, but velocity has a vector. So you can have plus or minus velocity, whereas speed doesn't. So if you treat, at least in this case, speed and velocity as very similar terms, speed, spasticity, is velocity dependent, because speed is very similar to velocity. rigidity is velocity independent. So athetoid movements are purposeless movements. Okay. Choreiform. Sometimes these are grouped together to form choreoathetoid CP. So choreiform, choreo from kind of choreographer means dance-like movements. So they're continuous purposeless movements. Rigidity is where you get increased tone, often in the absence of increased reflexes. Okay. So rigidity is velocity independent increases in tone. Ataxic is when you get problems with coordination of movement. It's the definition of ataxia. Probably the best way to demonstrate ataxia is to look at someone walking and doing heel to toe walking. Hypotonic are when they have low muscle tone. And then mixed is where they've got features of more than one type. So again, spasticity, speed, velocity. So it's velocity dependent. So chorea tend to be dance-like movements, and athetosis tend to be writhing movements. So that's how you can distinguish between them. The important thing about anatomy, and this is where really simply single best answer questions are made to be constructed from, are asking you what area of the brain is affected in different types of physiological cerebral palsy. So to ask you, a patient presents with spastic cerebral palsy, okay? So that is velocity-dependent increased tone, the most common form of cerebral palsy. What area of the brain is affected? And you would answer by saying motor cortex. So, of course, your motor cortex, your primary motor cortex, is in your cerebrum, okay? Or you could go one further and say it's the frontal lobe. So different answers, depending on what options they've got, would be either primary motor cortex, cerebrum, or frontal lobe. They all mean the same thing. They're just describing a different way of describing it. So it would be your motor cortex, your primary motor cortex, which is in the frontal lobe of your brain, which is in your cerebrum. Okay. So dyskinetic, which is these involuntary movements that you can get. So this would arise from basal ganglia damage. Okay. So basal ganglia damage. Okay, so dyskinetic, you would be circling or clicking basal ganglia as the area of pathology. Ataxic, when you get problems with balance and sense of position and space and gait disturbance, inability to heel to toe walk, you would click cerebellum. So spastic, motor cortex, dyskinetic, basal ganglia, ataxic, cerebellum. Okay. So the next bit in this podcast is we're going to talk about differential diagnosis, okay? So if you had a child presenting with spasticity, you might think cerebral palsy, but you might not think anything else. I'm just going to mention one other thing that it could be, okay? Don't bother regurgitating long lists, but 11-year-old boy with normal early development presents with declining school performance, behavioural changes with slowly progressive weakness. So in this case, we were dealing with someone with adrenoleukodystrophy. So adrenoleukodystrophy is very simple if you break it down. Adreno is probably your adrenal gland. So this should be suspected in any man that has got a diagnosis of primary adrenal insufficiency, something like Addison's. If any male that has got diagnosed a primary adrenal insufficiency should be screened for adrenoleukodystrophy. Okay, so you get problems with your adrenal gland and leuko meaning white. So you get problems with your white matter of your brain. So there is a degree of overlap, but grey matter disease tends to present with things like dementia, blindness and extra pyramidal signs. White matter disease tends to present with gross motor delay, weakness and incoordination. White matter, myelin makes it white. So it's due to the high lipid content of white matter that makes it show up white. And white matter, because it's myelinated, allows messages to pass quickly between different areas of grey matter. White matter disease is called leukodystrophy, And in this case, this boy had X-linked adrenoleukodystrophy that is X-linked and it causes problems with your adrenal glands. It can give you Addison's, and then leukodystrophy, problems with white matter. So boys can actually present with attention deficit disorder, ADD or ADHD, if they've got the hyperactivity. They also show signs of dementia, progressive behavioural disturbance, difficulty in understanding spoken language, incoordination, other neurological disturbances. They can have weakness, stiffness, rigidity. So these are all things that need to be considered. If you've got a child presenting with spasticity, okay, velocity dependent increase in tone, you need to think of X-linked adrenoleukodystrophy. And the main way that we look at it is we look at patient's plasma, very long chain fatty acids, okay? So X-linked adrenoleukodystrophy gives you elevated levels of your very long chain fatty acids. And you remember from physiology, a long chain fatty acid is anything more than 12 or more carbons long. Short chains less than 6, and mediums between 6 to 10. So if you are getting much longer than a 20 carbon fatty acid chain, you are then in the realm of very long chain fatty acids, okay? And we often give them something called Lorenzo's oil that is used to normalize your very long chain fatty acid levels. Dystonia. Well, actually, in our other podcasts on this channel, we've talked about two other conditions that can give you dystonia. One of them was a problem with an organic acidemia, which was glutaric aciduria type 1, which was can present with acute encephalopathy with acidosis and causes increased glutaric acid in your urine. We said that sometimes this can give you features and actually be misdiagnosed as non-accidental injury. The second one we've talked about loads is Leishmanian. So Leishmanian, the giveaway in exams is self-mutilatory behaviour, scratching, etc. And this causes increased uric acid in your plasma and your urine. So it was deficiency of your hypoxanthine purine transferase, which is an enzyme that breaks down uric acid. So HPRT, phosphorubal transferase, which helps break down uric acid. So if you can't break down uric acid, you get accumulation of uric acid. So we're beginning to construct some differential diagnosis for cerebral palsy. So we've talked about our first case, someone that presents with spasticity may have X-linked adrenoleukodystrophy. We've then talked about dystonia. So dystonia, so problems with your tone. That could be glutaric aciduria type 1 or Leishmanian syndrome. And then the last one we're going to look at in any amount of detail is, what about hypotonia? So if they presented with hypotonia, we might think about something like Zellweger syndrome. So not Renée Zellweger of the Bridget Jones's Diaries movies. But Zellweger syndrome is a defect of synthesis of something called peroxisomes. Now peroxisomes, I'm not going to try and flag it down too much, but peroxisomes are really important. We'll talk about them in a second. Patients with Zellweger syndrome have quite a high and prominent forehead. They have underdeveloped supraorbital ridges. They have quite a common and diagnostic facies. And they have a broad root of their nose. So they can present with very, very profound hypotonia, weakness and problems with feeding. And what we tend to do in this case is we measure their very long chain fatty acids as well, because peroxisomes are involved in the beta oxidation of very long chain fatty acids. So these patients can't undergo beta oxidation of their very long chain fatty acids. So their very long chain fatty acids tend to go up in Zellweger syndrome. So peroxisomes are involved in detoxification of alcohol. So if you drink alcohol and you think, oh gosh, how do I break down my alcohol? If you have a glass of wine or a pint of beer or something like that, peroxisomes detoxify about half the alcohol you drink daily. So if you don't think peroxisomes are important, either you don't drink alcohol or you've massively understated these biologically really important. So even if you take one thing from today, peroxisomes are really important in breaking down and detoxification of alcohol. The other thing that I wanted to mention is, now that we've talked about Zellweger syndrome can present with hypotonia as well, it's something called Leigh syndrome. So Leigh syndrome, also known as subacute necrotizing encephalomyelopathy. So this is cause you early onset neurodegenerative conditions. Do not remember any of these names of these conditions. They're not important. Leigh syndrome is a problem with failure of your mitochondrial respiratory chain, which is your electron transport chain, and can present with ataxia. If you don't think that your electron transport chain is really important, well, your electron transport chain allows you to undergo your Krebs cycle or your citric acid cycle, and is really, really important. So cyanide is often talked about. It comes up in things like MRCP and medical files. Cyanide actually inhibits your cytochrome C oxidase enzyme. So if you give someone cyanide, your electron transport chain can't pump electrons into your intermembrane space. So what happens is the pH of your intermembrane space would increase because you can't pump electrons in. Your pH gradient decreases and ATP synthesis stops. So Leigh syndrome is a problem with your electron transport chain. If you have problems with your electron transport chain, you can't pump electrons into the intermembrane space. The pH of the intermembrane space increases, which decreases your pH gradient, and your ATP synthesis stops. So there are a few things. And then if you've got generalized weakness, you're probably not thinking metabolic stuff as much, but you might be thinking potentially a muscular dystrophy pattern. The final thing, now that I've talked about some of the important differentials for cerebral palsy, are medications. And this is what we're going to wrap up on. So medications wise, diazepam is used in the management of cerebral palsy. What does diazepam do? It potentiates the effect of GABA, or gamma aminobutyric acid. GABA is an inhibitory neurotransmitter, so it's very good at dealing with the problems that cerebral palsy brings. Spasticity, increased tone, etc. If it's inhibitory, it decreases the chances of an action potential firing, which is what we want. So diazepam potentiates the effect of GABA. Baclofen mimics GABA. Okay. Botulism, or botulinum, that is formed from Clostridium botulinum, that causes botulism. So botulinum, or Botox toxin, is a potent neurotoxin. And how does it work? So Botox type A has basically been used to weaken muscles for a while, and it's selectively used, and you directly inject it into the muscle that you, calf muscle for example, that you want to relax. And what it does is it acts at the level of the motor end plate and blocks the release of acetylcholine. And if you haven't got acetylcholine release, then you don't get muscle contraction. Acetylcholine is really important for muscle contraction. Okay. So in summary, we've talked about the classification of cerebral palsy. We've talked about the physiological and the geographic. So the geographic, we talked about things like monoplegia would be one limb being affected. Diplegia would be the limb affected on both sides. We talked then about quadriplegia being four limbs being affected, and then total being four limbs plus head or neck involvement. We talked then about, if you like, a functional way of looking at things. So we talked about if you have got spastic cerebral palsy, the problem is the primary motor cortex. We then said dyskinetic cerebral palsy, the problems of the basal ganglia, and ataxic cerebral palsy, the problems in the cerebellum. We then talked about the differential diagnosis. So we mentioned a few conditions that you don't have to commit to memory. It's to illustrate a point. Not all patients with spasticity have got cerebral palsy. Patients with, just to make an example, patients that have got spasticity could have X-linked adrenoleukodystrophy, which when you get adrenal involvement, so they can have an Addison's-like picture, and leukodystrophy, that means problems with white matter, and they have increased amounts of very long-chain fatty acids. And we can give the Lorenzo's oil to equilibrate their balance of fatty acids. We talked about dystonic cerebral palsy in two differentials. Glutaric aciduria type 1, which is an organic acidemia that can present with acute encephalopathy with acidosis, and the amount of glutaric acid in your urine would go up. Lechnaien syndrome, where you can't metabolise uric acid and you can get self-mutilatory behaviour. Hypotonia, your Zellweger syndrome, which is a problem with peroxisome synthesis. Said that your very long-chain fatty acids go up because peroxisomes help break down very long-chain fatty acids. We also said that peroxisomes detoxify about half of the alcohol that someone drinks per day. Leigh syndrome is an early-onset neurodegenerative condition, and it's a problem with your electron transport chain. We said that cyanide shows the example of why your electron transport chain is really important, because if it stops working, you can't generate ATP. Finally, we talked about medications, that the diazepam potentiates the effect of GABA, which is an inhibitory neurotransmitter, and that baclofen mimics GABA. Botox is a way of selectively weakening certain muscles that you want. You directly inject it into the muscle in question, and it acts at the level of the motor endplane, blocks the release of acetylcholine, and inhibits muscle contraction. So they're the main things that we've talked about today. Thank you very much for listening, and that is our neurology mini-series wrapped up. Thank you very much for listening.